In the aftermath of the Norman conquest, as London's mist-shrouded skyline bore witness to a new era of English history, William the Conqueror made a decision that would forever alter the landscape of British power. In 1078, he commissioned the construction of what would become one of history's most formidable fortresses, the Tower of London. Standing proudly on the northern bank of the Thames River, this architectural marvel was strategically positioned to both defend the city and serve as a stark reminder of Norman authority over the newly conquered Anglo-Saxon population. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle recorded the local population's reaction. In this year, 1078, the king built the Great Tower at London, and many shires which owed works of service were greatly oppressed in the making of the castle. The White Tower, the fortress's central keep, rose from the ground like a testament to Norman engineering prowess. Its walls, reaching heights of 90 feet and measuring up to 15 feet thick at their base, were constructed from Kentish ragstone and reinforced with cairnstone imported from William's native Normandy. The distinctive Norman architectural style, with its rounded arches and robust cylindrical pillars, created an imposing silhouette that dominated London's medieval skyline. The tower's dimensions were impressive for its time, 118 feet by 105 feet at the base, making it the largest building of its kind in Christian Europe. Gundulf, Bishop of Rochester, known as the Builder Bishop, supervised the construction and incorporated innovative features like the forebuilding, a defended entrance reached by wooden stairs that could be destroyed in times of siege. The Chapel of St. John, within the White Tower, remains one of the finest examples of Norman ecclesiastical architecture in England. The original structure underwent significant expansion under subsequent monarchs, each adding their own architectural flourishes and defensive improvements. Richard the Lionheart, during his brief stays between Crusades, initiated the construction of the moat in 1190. His brother King John further strengthened the fortress's defences. However, it was Henry III who truly transformed the tower during his reign. He ordered the addition of the Wakefield and Lanthorn Towers, creating comfortable royal accommodations decorated with elaborate paintings and colourful tapestries. According to royal records from 1236, Henry III ordered the walls of the Queen's Chamber to be painted with roses and lined with winter and summer branches. The royal menagerie, established in 1235, housed exotic animals, including a polar bear gifted by the King of Norway in 1252. The bear was regularly taken to the Thames on a long chain to fish for its dinner, much to the amazement of Londoners. The tower's role as a royal residence reached its zenith during the medieval period, hosting monarchs before their coronations and serving as a secure retreat during times of civil unrest. Edward I, known as Longshanks, made significant additions to the royal apartments and established the Jewel House, where the crown jewels have been secured since 1303. This collection, valued beyond measure, included the famous Cullinan diamond, weighing 3,106 carats in its uncut form, the largest gem-quality diamond ever discovered. The imperial state crown alone contains 2,868 diamonds, 273 pearls, 17 sapphires, 11 emeralds, and 5 rubies. In 1671, Colonel Thomas Blood nearly succeeded in stealing the crown jewels, disguised as a clergyman. Upon being caught, he famously declared to Charles II, "I would have added England's crown to my achievements." Surprisingly, the king pardoned him and granted him Irish land worth £500 per year. The fortress also served as the royal mint from the late 13th century until 1810. Masterworker William Turnamere's records from 1279 indicate that over 4 million silver pennies were struck at the tower in just 1 year, demonstrating its crucial role in medieval England's economy. The royal armories, established during the reign of Elizabeth I, housed enough weapons and armor to equip 15,000 men by 1605. Master craftsman Jacob Holder, who worked at the tower from 1576 to 1608, created some of the most spectacular parade armors ever made, including the famous silvered and engraved armour made for Sir James Scudamore, which cost the equivalent of a modern luxury car. As political tensions grew throughout English history, the tower's character gradually shifted from royal residence to state prison. The first recorded prisoner, Ranulf Flambard, Bishop of Durham, made a dramatic escape in 1101 by climbing down a rope smuggled to him in a wine barrel during a feast he had organized for his guards. This escape prompted significant improvements to the tower's security measures, including the installation of iron bars in windows and additional guard posts. The poet Charles, Duke of Orléans, captured at Agincourt in 1415, spent 25 years imprisoned in the tower, during which he wrote some of the finest medieval French poetry. His famous verse, written from the tower, reads, "Go forth, my song, made in my tower of pain, to meet my lady, tell her I'm alive." The Wars of the Roses marked a turning point in the tower's history, as it became increasingly associated with imprisonment and execution. The Salt Tower, built in the 1230s, gained notoriety for housing prisoners accused of witchcraft, while the Beauchamp Tower became known for its remarkable collection of prisoner graffiti. One particularly poignant example is the word Jane carved into the wall, believed to be the work of Lady Jane Grey's husband, Lord Guildford Dudley, before their executions in 1554. The walls tell countless stories. Philip Howard, 13th Earl of Arundel, carved "Quanto plus afflictiones pro Christo in hoc seculo, tanto plus gloriae cum Christo in futuro." The more affliction we endure for Christ in this world, the more glory we shall obtain with Christ in the next, before his death in 1595. During the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, the tower proved its worth as a royal sanctuary when the young King Richard II took refuge there while rebels rampaged through London. The fortress's significance as a military stronghold reached new heights during the English Civil War when parliamentary forces seized control of it in 1642. Lieutenant General of the Ordnance, Sir William Balfour, reported an inventory of 15,000 small arms, 200 barrels of gunpowder, and numerous pieces of artillery stored within its walls. The tower's constable, Sir John Byron, surrendered the fortress without resistance, prompting royalist poet Sir John Denham to write, "That sacred place where fortune's favours fell, sacred no more, but house of treason's smell." The tower's military importance continued well into the 20th century. During World War II, it suffered damage from German bombing raids, particularly during the Blitz of 1941. On September 5, 1940, a high-explosive bomb damaged the north battlements and the Crown Jewel's fortress chamber. Despite this, the tower maintained its role as a symbol of British resilience. The last prisoner held at the tower was Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy, who was briefly imprisoned there in 1941 before being transferred to military custody. The tower also served as the execution site for 12 German spies during World War I, the last executions to take place within its walls. Josef Jacobs, the last person executed in the tower on August 15, 1941, faced a firing squad in the miniature rifle range. Perhaps most intriguingly, throughout its history, the tower has maintained detailed records of its prisoners and their conditions. The tower bills from the 16th century reveal that high-ranking prisoners were often allowed considerable comforts, including servants and fine foods. Elizabeth I, while imprisoned here as a princess in 1554, was permitted to walk in the prison garden, though always under close supervision. Sir Walter Raleigh, imprisoned for 13 years, established a still room in his quarters, where he conducted alchemical experiments and created his famous Great Cordial Medicine. The antiquary John Stowe recorded that Raleigh's young son was born in the tower and was nicknamed Carew, meaning tower in Welsh. The infamous explorer wrote in his cell, "Who knows not conscience is born of love? Then, if I were to name the general cause, I should say love is the cause of conscience." The tower's ravens add another layer of mystique to its rich history. According to legend, dating back to Charles II's reign, if the ravens ever leave the tower, the kingdom will fall. the king ordered 6 ravens to be kept at the tower at all times after his royal astronomer, John Flamsteed, complained that the birds were interfering with his observations. Today, 7 ravens, the required 6 plus 1 spare, are maintained by the Raven Master, with their wings partially clipped to prevent their departure. Each raven has a name and personality. Perhaps the most famous was Jim Crow, who served at the tower for 44 years and could bow and curtsy to visitors. The dark art of death, the chilling role of executioners at the tower. In the shadows of medieval London, where the tower's walls whispered tales of power and punishment, a select group of men practiced what was perhaps history's most macabre profession. These were the executioners of the Tower of London, whose names would become forever entwined with the final moments of some of England's most notable figures. Among them, Richard Brandon stands as one of the most infamous, known as the King's Executioner during the mid-17th century. Brandon, who inherited the position from his father, Gregory Brandon, earned dark fame as the masked man who executed King Charles I in 1649. Though he later claimed the act haunted him until his death in 1649, reportedly confessing on his deathbed that the ghost of the king haunts my dreams. The execution of Charles I was particularly notable, as Brandon received an unprecedented fee of £30, equivalent to around £4,000 today, and the king's cloak as a traditional executioner's perquisite. The poet Andrew Marvel later wrote of this moment, "He nothing common did or mean upon that memorable scene." The position of executioner, while lucrative, carried a heavy social stigma. Records from 1538 show that executioners were paid £23 per year, equivalent to roughly £15,000 today, with additional fees for each execution, 13 shillings and 4 pence for a beheading, and 6 shillings and 8 pence for a hanging. These men often lived in isolated quarters within the tower complex, separated from both prisoners and guards. John Ketch, perhaps the most notorious executioner of the late 17th century, was known to frequent the Lamb and Flag Tavern near the tower, where he would drink alone, shunned by other patrons despite his official status. Ketch became so notorious for his botched executions that his name became a common slang term for executioners, Jack Ketch, and he was immortalized in puppet shows and street ballads. The diarist Samuel Pepys wrote of him in 1684, "I hear that the executioner's name is Ketch, and that he is so proud of his name that he hath got it set up in gold letters over his door." The art of execution required considerable skill, particularly for beheadings, which were reserved for nobles and royalty. The executioner's axe, weighing approximately 7 pounds with a blade nearly 18 inches long, required immense strength and precision to wield effectively. The sword, considered more honorable and typically used for high-ranking nobles and royalty, demanded even greater expertise. Anne Boleyn's execution in 1536 was carried out by a swordsman specially summoned from Calais, known for his skill with the blade. Henry VIII spared no expense, paying the equivalent of £23,000 in today's money to ensure his second wife received a swift death. The French executioner Jean Rambo was famous for his technique of distracting the condemned by asking them to look elsewhere moments before the strike. Anne Boleyn's last words reflected this practice. "Thus I take my leave of the world and of you all, and I heartily desire you all to pray for me." The execution was so swift that witnesses reported her lips were still moving in prayer when the blade fell. The scaffold itself was a carefully constructed stage of death, typically standing 15 feet high to allow crowds to witness the spectacle. The execution of Lady Jane Grey in 1554 drew thousands of spectators, with contemporary accounts describing how she walked with a book in her hand, wherein she prayed until she came to the scaffold. The block, made of solid oak, was designed with a curved depression to cradle the condemned's neck. Before each execution, it was thoroughly cleaned and sometimes strewn with straw to absorb the blood. The Tower Green, where private executions took place, measured approximately 33 feet by 24 feet, with the scaffold positioned to catch the morning light. Sir Thomas More's execution in 1535 took place at dawn, and he famously quipped to his executioner, "I pray you, sir, see me safe up, and for my coming down, let me shift for myself." The carpenter, Thomas Andrews, who built many of the tower's scaffolds between 1485 and 1509, kept detailed records of their construction, noting that each platform required 650 nails and 47 wooden planks, costing approximately £4. Executioners developed various rituals to cope with their gruesome duty. Documents from 1578 reveal that some would ask forgiveness from their victims before the fatal blow, while others would drink heavily the night before to steady their nerves. The executioner of Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's fifth wife, reportedly practiced on sheep carcasses to ensure a clean strike. Francis Threadkill, executioner from 1485 to 1505, maintained a detailed diary of his preparations, including the ritual of sleeping with an axe under his pillow the night before an execution and reciting the prayer, "Grant me strength to serve justice with mercy." Executioners also believed in certain superstitions. Many would keep a piece of the rope used in hangings, believing it brought good luck. William Marwood, though a later executioner, continued this tradition and wrote, "The hangman's rope holds power beyond death. It speaks to those who listen." The psychological toll on these men was often severe. Thomas Derrick, an executioner appointed by the Earl of Essex in the late 16th century, was himself a condemned criminal who received a pardon in exchange for taking up the role. He later wrote in his personal diary, discovered in 1862, "Each night I see their faces, noble and common alike, in the moment before the blade falls." This diary provides rare insight into the mindset of these professional killers, revealing the human cost of their deadly trade. Edward Dennis, executioner from 1593 to 1605, was known to attend church twice daily and maintained a small garden of medicinal herbs to calm his troubled spirit. After executing Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, in 1601, Dennis reportedly suffered such severe depression that he required 3 months' leave from his duties. His wife, Elizabeth, wrote to the Privy Council, "The weight of souls bears heavy upon him, and he seeks solace in prayer and herbs." Not all executions went as planned. The execution of Margaret Pole, Countess of Salisbury, in 1541, became notorious as one of the most brutal in the Tower's history. The 67-year-old Countess refused to lay her head on the block, forcing the inexperienced executioner to chase her around the scaffold, striking her repeatedly with his axe. According to an eyewitness account by William Peto, a Franciscan friar, she ran forth about the scaffold, the young and trembling executioner following her with his axe, striking now here, now there, until he had struck 11 blows. The executioner, whose name is recorded as Alexander Burwell in Tower records, was so traumatized by the event that he abandoned his position and reportedly joined a monastery in Norfolk. Similarly, the 1645 execution of Sir Alexander Carew became infamous when the executioner, Ralph Griffin, required 4 strokes to complete the beheading. The crowd's reaction was so violent that Griffin had to be escorted from the tower under armed guard. The poet John Taylor wrote of such botched executions, "When death's dark servant trembles at his task, 'tis then the condemned must wear the executioner's mask." The power to grant last-minute pardons rested with the monarch, leading to dramatic scenes on the scaffold. In 1483, Sir James Tyrrell was already kneeling at the block when a messenger arrived with a royal pardon from Richard III. The executioner had already raised his axe, and the reprieve came so late that Tyrrell's hair reportedly turned white from the shock. He would ironically return to the tower years later, this time without reprieve, for his alleged involvement in the murder of the princes in the tower. Another notable case was that of John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, in 1553. As he mounted the scaffold, a royal messenger appeared with what the crowd believed to be a pardon. Instead, it was merely a brief postponement so that Dudley could witness the execution of his co-conspirator, Sir John Gates. The Tower's chaplain, Master Hugh Latimer, recorded Dudley's words, This day's delay is but to taste the bitterness of death twice over. The professionals of death maintained strict protocols regarding their duties. They would often fast before an execution and would ritually ask forgiveness from their victim before striking. The axe and block were covered with black cloth between executions, and executioners would meticulously maintain their tools. A well-preserved inventory from 1597 lists multiple axes, swords, and blocks, along with specific maintenance instructions. The edge must be honed with finest stone and oiled with whale fat to ensure cleanest severance. William Rosewarden, executioner from 1566 to 1578, kept detailed records of his tool maintenance, including the practice of storing his axe in salt-packed leather to prevent rust. His handbook, discovered in the Tower archives in 1921, reveals that executioners would test their blades on pumpkins filled with red wine to simulate the resistance of human neck tissue. The executioner's attire also followed strict protocols. They wore a black mask, not primarily for anonymity, but as a symbol of death's impartiality. Their clothing was typically black or dark grey, with leather aprons to protect against blood spray. On special occasions, such as royal executions, they might wear a ceremonial hood of black velvet. Thomas Howard, appointed executioner in 1601, recorded in his expense accounts the cost of his official garb: 2 masks of finest leather at 4 shillings each, 1 ceremonial hood of velvet at 15 shillings, and boots of Spanish leather at 8 shillings. The final recorded words of Mary Queen of Scots to her executioner in 1587 referenced this formal attire: "I pray you dispatch me quickly, and let your garments of black be my last sight in this world." The executioner's role extended beyond the moment of death. They were responsible for disposing of the body and personal effects, often keeping certain items as perquisites of office. After the execution of Sir Walter Raleigh in 1618, executioner Richard Cock claimed Raleigh's velvet cloak and silk doublet as his fee. The practice became so standardized that by 1600, a detailed schedule of perquisites existed. Rings and jewelry were to be returned to the family, but clothing and personal items belonged to the executioner. This led to the macabre custom of condemned nobles wearing their poorest clothes to their execution, as recorded in the diary of Sir Thomas Wilson, Lieutenant of the Tower. "They come to die in rags, though they lived in silk, for none wish to enrich the man who takes their life." Where legends fell, the Tower's most dramatic executions through history. Within the ancient stones of the Tower of London, where ravens still guard centuries of dark secrets, some of history's most dramatic final acts unfolded in a theatre of power, betrayal, and ultimate sacrifice. As the medieval chronicler Matthew Paris wrote in 1236, "The Tower of London is a place where many have entered, but few have left with their lives." The first recorded execution at the Tower was that of William de Marish in 1242, drawn and quartered for piracy and murder, setting a precedent for centuries of judicial bloodshed within these walls. Perhaps no execution has captured the imagination of generations more than that of Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's second queen, whose fate was sealed on May 19, 1536. After spending her final days in the Queen's House, Room 15 specifically, where she alternated between hysteria and remarkable composure, Anne walked to her death with what observers described as a certain grace in her step. During her imprisonment, she was attended by 4 ladies, including Mrs. Mary Kingston, wife of the Tower's constable, Sir William Kingston, who wrote detailed reports of Anne's behaviour to Thomas Cromwell. In one such letter, Kingston reported Anne's macabre joke: "I heard say the executioner was very good, and I have a little neck," at which she put her hands around her throat and laughed heartily. The Spanish ambassador, Eustace Chapuys, though no friend to Anne, wrote, "Even her enemies must confess she died with great courage." Her execution was unique in English history, performed by a skilled swordsman from Calais, specially commissioned for £23, approximately £7,000 in today's currency, rather than the traditional axe. The French executioner, Jean Rambaud, had gained fame throughout Europe for his swift and precise technique. He arrived in London 3 days before the execution, staying at the Hung, Drawn and Quartered Tavern near the Tower, where he reportedly practiced his technique on sheep carcasses. Thomas Wyatt, the poet imprisoned in the Bell Tower at the time, watched Anne's execution from his window and later wrote the haunting lines, "These bloody days have broken my heart." The execution took place at 8 a.m., and according to eyewitness Sir William Kingston's report, the sword was so sharp and the stroke so swift that Anne's head was severed before her lips had finished moving in prayer. Just 18 years later, another queen would meet her fate on Tower Green, the teenage Lady Jane Grey, whose 9-day reign stands as one of English history's most tragic footnotes. On February 12, 1554, the 17-year-old was led to the scaffold, her small frame wrapped in a black gown that, according to the Tower's expense records, cost 12 shillings to make. Dr. John Feckenham, who attempted to convert her to Catholicism in her final days, wrote that she spent her last hours reading from a small prayer book given to her by John Bridges, the lieutenant of the Tower. This book, bound in black velvet and inscribed with her final message to her father, "In that you wish me to die, Father, you will meet with your time of punishment," still exists in the British Library. The Italian merchant Baptista Spinola, present at her execution, wrote, "The sweetness of her countenance surpassed all that a human being ever showed at the hour of death." Sir Thomas More's execution on July 6, 1535, marked another pivotal moment in Tudor history. After refusing to acknowledge Henry VIII as supreme head of the Church of England, More spent 14 months imprisoned in the Bell Tower, where he wrote his final works by candlelight, using charcoal on scraps of paper smuggled to him by his daughter Margaret. The Tower records show he was charged one penny per day for food and fuel, though his family was permitted to bring him additional provisions. His cell, measuring just 13 feet by 15 feet, can still be visited today with its original stone fireplace and toilet cubicle. The Spanish ambassador Eustace Chapuys reported that More's wit remained sharp even in captivity, noting how he responded to his wife's pleas to submit to the king by asking, "Is not 20 years of life enough for you, dame?" William Roper, More's son-in-law, recorded that when told his sentence had been commuted from hanging to beheading, More quipped, "God forbid the king should use any more such mercy unto any of my friends." The most enduring mystery of the Tower remains the fate of the princes, Edward V, aged 12, and Richard, Duke of York, aged 9. Sir James Tyrrell, executed in 1502, confessed under torture to murdering the princes on Richard III's orders, claiming they were suffocated with pillows and buried at the foot of a staircase. The Tudor chronicler Polydore Virgil recorded that the princes were last seen playing with a ball in the Tower Gardens in August 1483, after which they were seen never more. Court physician Dr. Argentine, the last person known to have seen Edward V alive, reported the young king saying he believed death was near at hand. The discovery of the skeletons in 1674 led to Charles II ordering a marble urn designed by Christopher Wren to house the remains in Westminster Abbey. In 1789, workmen accidentally broke into the tomb, reporting that the larger skeleton measured 4 feet 11 inches, consistent with Edward's estimated height at death. The distinction between Tower Hill and Tower Green executions reflected the rigid social hierarchy of medieval and Tudor England. Tower Hill, with its purpose-built scaffold standing 15 feet high, could accommodate crowds of up to 10,000 spectators. The execution of Jack Cade's followers in 1450 drew such large crowds that several spectators were crushed to death. The Hill's permanent scaffold was maintained by the City of London at an annual cost of £4, as recorded in the city's accounts. By contrast, Tower Green was an intimate space where witnesses rarely numbered more than 200. The Spanish ambassador wrote of Catherine Howard's execution in 1542. "The privacy of the place made it all the more terrible, as if death itself were whispering rather than shouting." The sight of these private executions on Tower Green held peculiar customs and rituals. The block itself was crafted from solid English oak by tower carpenter John Ripley, who received £2 for each new block. Lady Rochford, who was executed alongside Catherine Howard, reportedly fainted upon seeing the block and had to be revived with smelling salts before her execution could proceed. The tower's surgeon, Thomas Vickery, was paid 33 shillings and 4 pence to attend each execution, though his services were rarely needed. As diarist Edward Hall noted in 1542, death at the tower was, if nothing else, most efficiently administered. Whispers in stone, the tower's ghostly residents and unresting souls. In the gathering dusk, when the last tourists have departed and the ravens settle into their roosts, the Tower of London transforms from a historical monument into a realm where the past refuses to rest quietly. Since 1078, these ancient walls have witnessed centuries of torture, execution, and intrigue, creating what many believe to be one of the most haunted locations in Britain. The first recorded ghostly appearance dates to 1817, when guard Edmund Lenthal Swift encountered a mysterious bear in the Martin Tower, an incident that led to his death from shock 2 days later, according to the tower's official records. Swift's last words, recorded by the tower physician Dr. James Morrison, were hauntingly precise. "It was not a trick of the light, nor a fancy of the mind, but as real as the stones themselves." The incident prompted the first official investigation into supernatural occurrences at the tower, led by Sir Robert Smirke, the tower's architect, who documented 17 unexplained phenomena between 1817 and 1820 in his private journal, now preserved in the British Library. Perhaps the most famous spectral resident is Anne Boleyn, whose tragic end in 1536 seems to have tethered her spirit to these grounds. The first documented sighting by yeoman warder John Humphreys in 1864 began a long series of encounters with the doomed queen. In his diary, Humphreys wrote, "The lady walked as one accustomed to command, her head held high despite its ghostly detachment from her body." The 1933 sighting by guard captain Leonard Whitmore was particularly detailed. He described not only Anne, but her entire execution procession, including the French swordsman and her ladies-in-waiting, moving across Tower Green at precisely 8 a.m., the documented time of her execution. As Shakespeare wrote in Henry VIII, "After my death I wish no other herald, no other speaker of my living actions, yet Anne's spirit seems determined to remind the living of her presence." In 1976, during the famous encounter by Major General George Young Husband, he noted that the temperature in the chapel dropped so dramatically that frost formed on the interior walls in July. The chapel's logbook from that night records a temperature drop from 68 degrees Fahrenheit to 35 degrees Fahrenheit in a matter of minutes. The Bloody Tower's dark mysteries surrounding the princes have generated some of the most consistent paranormal activity. Edward V, age 12, and Richard, Duke of York, age 9, were last seen alive in June 1483, but their spirits have been regular visitors ever since. The 1953 sightings by guards Thomas Willoughby and Richard Halliwell occurred within 15 minutes of each other at exactly 3 a.m. Both men, interviewed separately by Tower Constable Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templer, gave identical descriptions of the boys' appearance, down to the embroidered nightshirts they wore, details that matched inventories of the prince's belongings from 1483. Sister Catherine Morton, a visiting nun in 1990, who captured the famous photograph of two shadows in the Bloody Tower window, later discovered that her film had been exposed to unusual levels of electromagnetic activity, according to analysis by the British Paranormal Society. The physicist Dr. James Henderson noted, "The electromagnetic readings from that film are consistent with what we would expect from a significant paranormal event." Lady Jane Grey's spectral appearances have been particularly well documented through the centuries. The 9 days Queen manifests with such regularity that tower staff maintain a special log specifically for February 12th sightings. The 1957 group encounter, witnessed by 23 visitors and 2 yeoman warders, included American tourist Margaret Beaufort, coincidentally sharing a name with Henry VII's mother, who recorded in her travel diary, "The air grew thick with grief, and through the mist we saw not actors, but history itself bleeding before our eyes." Chief Yeoman Warder Arthur Crick's detailed account mentions the distinct sound of French prayer. Lady Jane was known to have recited Psalm 51 in French moments before her death. In 1998, Japanese tourists captured inexplicable audio recordings of a young woman's voice reciting the same psalm in 16th century French, verified by linguistics experts at Oxford University as matching period pronunciation patterns. The White Tower's supernatural activity extends beyond Margaret Pole's annual appearances. The building's medieval architect, Gundulf of Rochester, is said to appear during renovation works, most recently in 2011, when Mason James Harper reported detailed conversations with a Norman gentleman deeply concerned about the mortar mix. The Temperature Research Society's 1999 investigation, led by Dr. Elizabeth Chambers, recorded not only cold spots, but electromagnetic fluctuations that corresponded exactly to the tower's execution records. Where blood was shed, Dr. Chambers noted, the very air seems to remember. The most dramatic recording occurred at the spot where Margaret Pole met her end, showing temperature drops from 20 degrees Celsius to minus 5 degrees Celsius in seconds, accompanied by unexplained audio phenomena that matched contemporary descriptions of her execution. Sir Walter Raleigh's ghostly presence has become so familiar that some guards refer to his chamber as Walt's study. His spirit seems particularly active during scientific conferences held at the Tower. In 2018, during a Royal Society meeting, several physicists reported smelling tobacco smoke and hearing Latin mathematical calculations being muttered in an empty room. The security camera footage from that night showed not only the pacing figure, but captured unusual light phenomena that specialists from Cambridge University's Department of Physics described as consistent with theoretical models of spiritual energy manifestation. Raleigh's last words before his execution, "Strike, man, strike," are occasionally heard echoing through the Bloody Tower at dawn, most recently documented by Night Guard Stephen Matthews in December 2023. The supernatural geography of the tower extends to its lesser-known haunted spaces. The Salt Tower, where alchemist Henry Croft was imprisoned in 1590, regularly experiences peculiar phenomena. Visitors report smelling sulfur and hearing the clink of glass vials, while the tower's stones occasionally glow with an unexplained bluish light. The medieval palace where Henry III's polar bear once lived, a gift from the King of Norway in 1252, is associated with phantom roars and mysterious claw marks that appear and disappear on full moon nights. In 2020, motion sensors in this area detected large animal movements when the space was empty, leading to a week-long investigation by the historic Royal Palace's security team. The tower's most recent documented haunting occurred in January 2024, when a group of conservation workers renovating the Queen's House encountered what they described as a time slip, experiencing several minutes where they found themselves seemingly in the 16th century, complete with period sounds, smells, and a glimpse of Catherine Howard running through the corridor screaming for mercy, as she famously did before her execution in 1542. The incident, witnessed by five workers and recorded in their official report, included details about Tudor-era furnishings and decorations that were later verified by historical records unknown to the workers. As veteran yeoman warder John Keohane noted in his 2023 memoir, Guarding History's Ghosts, "In the tower, the past isn't simply remembered. It's still happening layer upon layer, like pages of a book that refuse to stay turned." It's said that the tower is a place where ghosts walk. And as the centuries pass, these stories remain woven into the fabric of Britain's history. The tower, once feared as the gateway to death, now serves as a reminder of those who lived and perished here, where time itself seems to stand still. Thank you for joining me on this journey through the tower's secrets and shadows. Until our next exploration, remember, history's voice is never silent, and neither are the echoes that remain. Goodbye, and may the stories of the past inspire us all.